This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, Vermont's Attorney General put retailers and businesses that charge more for women's items than for men's items on notice, saying the practice is illegal if the item or service is not significantly different. The AG said he hopes highlighting this issue will lead to some changes, but he also says he's not afraid to name names, make examples of companies, and enforce the law against gender discrimination. The AG's office is also busy right now with issues relating to Vermont's GMO labeling law, which went into effect on Friday. There's federal legislation pending in the Senate that could significantly impact Vermont's law. Retailers, companies, and states are keeping an eye on that. Sorrell has a few months left in charge of the state's top legal and law enforcement office before a new AG takes the reins. Sorrell has served in this position since 1997 and says it's time for someone else to lead. Today on the show, Attorney General Bill Sorrell joins us to talk about the legal issues he's working on in Vermont and to answer your questions. Post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Attorney General Sorrell, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for asking me, Jane.
So July 1st was the start date of Vermont's GMO labeling law, which, again, requires manufacturers to put a label, an actual label, on the product itself if it is made with or contains or may contain genetically modified ingredients. But although the law went into effect on Friday, companies still have a grace period in which they can get rid of all of their old product line that didn't have the labels. And some companies have already started complying with the law. So are consumers actually seeing anything significantly different on their store shelves?
Well, it depends on the company, but it's going to be a gradual process. But of course, the legislature knew that you couldn't change this kind of thing overnight. And so when they enacted the law 2 years ago, they gave more than two full years sort of notice of this labeling obligation. And then they ordered us essentially to go through a rulemaking process to put flesh on the bones, if you will, of the statute. And we did that on an expedited basis, and the legislature approved our enabling regulations prior to July 1 of last year. So a full year with the regulations in place, two full years with the law in place. And so, you know, there were a few companies that are going, oh, we can't comply, we don't know what we have to do and this and that. But the truth of the matter is Friday came and went and the sky didn't fall, and we're going to see more and more products on Vermont food shelves that have that information in the same way that you have information on calorie counts, sodium, sugar, that is there for those for whom it's important to know whether their foods are produced with genetic engineering. That information is going to be there. And
so are you just like hanging out now and waiting? I mean, is there anything for your office to do? You've made the rules. The law is in effect for now. And there's this grace period. So do you have to do anything?
Well, we're doing a lot because we've been sued, and we are in federal court, both here in Vermont at the trial level, and we've argued and are awaiting a decision from the Intermediate Federal Appeals Court in New York City. And so I've got several people working all but full time on GMO labeling issues, quite apart from enforcement. And thus far, we're prevailing on the important issue, which is the mandated labeling of foods that are produced with genetic engineering. We could hear from the Second Circuit any day now, but thus far, our chief U.S. District Court judge in Vermont, in a lengthy decision, indicated that in all likelihood she will uphold the labeling requirement, which is the heart and soul of the statute.
Of course, there's also this question, though, of what the federal government is going to do. And last week we had Congressman Peter Welch on the program. He had really harsh words for a GMO labeling bill that has made it through the Senate Agricultural Committee.
It's a really stupid compromise. I mean, the point of labeling is to let the person looking at the product, making a decision about whether to buy it, know what's in that product that they're about to buy. It's the right of a consumer to know. usually English works best. You pick up a label and you can see how much sugar is in there, and you know it's enough or it's too much. What vitamins are in there? You can look at that. How many calories are there? What this quote compromise says is that if you can read a barcode, or you or have your iPhone and you can scan a barcode and then interpret what that barcode says, that's the step they're imposing on consumers to get to the information.
So again, this bill, should it move through, would require labeling. But as Congressman Welch said, it might require it in a QR code that you have to scan with your phone.
Or an 800 number that you have to call.
Right, or a website.
It's not even labeling light.
So you agree with the congressman who says it's a really stupid compromise.
I don't think it's a compromise. This is not a consumer-friendly proposal. This is an industry-friendly proposal. And can you imagine going to the grocery store and you forget your cell phone, your smartphone out in your car, or you've left it at home and saying, you know, honey, which soup should we buy? Well, wait a minute. I got to get my smartphone to read the barcode, or I've got to call this 800 number. I mean, the point is the industry says GMOs are not harmful at all. They're fine.
Industry and the majority of scientists.
That is true thus far. But there are others who have legitimate concerns, and thus we have prevailed thus far in legitimate governmental interest in people knowing what's in their foods. We hope ultimately to prevail on that. But this proposal, wealthy corporate interests and their influence in Washington are trying to run this by and preempt the states. And, you know, this is not a conservative versus liberals issue. This is not Republicans versus Democrats, blue versus red states, whatever. All of the polling shows that Americans, without regard to income level, to education level, political leanings, want to know what's in their foods. And so it would be really appalling if a conservative majority in the Congress goes against American consumers of all stripes. So there's a lot of fighting left to be done, and our law is in effect. And it would be a shame if the supposed know-it-alls in Washington say, no, you in the state capitals, we can't trust you doing this. It's just not respectful of us as states, as laboratories of democracy. We might have constitutional arguments that a federal law was not adequately respectful of our state authority, but that's a long ways down the road. It's got to get out of the Senate, got to get out of the House, and the White House has to take action. So in the meantime, our law's in effect, and Vermonters are well served by it.
Attorney General Sorrell, you mentioned that Vermonters will be seeing more labels on the shelves, you know, as companies move through their old product line and have to have the new labels on. But there are companies like Coca-Cola who say, forget it. We're just not going to sell our products here.
Well, actually, that's been reported. And what I've also read from a subsequent media interview, and I've had no personal interaction with Coca-Cola, but
nor have I.
What they supposedly they're saying now is that there are certain products that are in small servings that are not labeled, and so temporarily they're not going to be putting those on shelves in Vermont, even though the reality is they've got a six-month grace period. As long as the labeling was done before July 1st, they may sell those products in Vermont grocery stores and grocery stores. You know, this is a lot like what we heard when Vermont adopted the so-called California emission standard, the on emissions pollutants from automobiles. You heard the auto industry going, oh, we're not going to sell cars in Vermont. It's going to cost cars to be way more expensive in Vermont. This is ridiculous. It's violating our constitutional rights not to have to do this and that. And, you know, the sky is falling kind of arguments. The sky is not going to fall. American consumers want this information, and I think at the end of the day we're going to have it.
Although, of course, the caveat in that is that we were also paired with California on that, which has a much, much higher population and much more consumer power than Vermont.
Absolutely.
Does.
But we did initially have mercury labeling requirement, which is now the standard nationally. So, you know, the reality is the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution gives a heck of a lot of authority to individual states to be – to lead the charge. And Vermont hasn't been afraid to wear that hat since our first constitution, which banned slavery. You know, universal male suffrage, the right for men to vote without regard to property ownership. We've been out there like that, and I think that's something that Vermonters are proud of. We've had a couple of tough outings before the U.S. Supreme Court, and, you know, there are a lot of all-stars in the baseball game in a couple of weeks who don't get a hit every time up either, you know. So we're going to keep trying.
We're talking today with Attorney General Bill Sorrell. And if you have a question for him on GMO labeling, we're going to talk about the Volkswagen settlements. We're going to look at toxic substances and other issues that his office is dealing with. You can call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that number is 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Patrick who says, as an owner of a small country store, I needed to familiarize myself with the new GMO law. Whether I agree with it or not was not an issue, but as a store owner, I am charged with carrying out the law or I'm subject to fines. So I called the AG's office for information. The woman who answered walked me through how to download the law itself and then a list of frequently asked questions. Then she said, if you have any other questions, you need to go through your lawyer. To which I replied, I have to pay $250 an hour to ask a question to make sure I'm in compliance with the law. And she repeated herself, end of conversation. When printing the FAQ sheet, it says at the bottom in bold print, do not call this office with questions. This to a brand new law that is the first of its kind. As a new business, I have a lot of questions. If I need clarification on taxes, the Department of Taxes is very helpful. Same with the Secretary of State's office, Department of Waste Management, and so forth. But with the AG's office, I was made to feel that I was not good enough to ask a question on my own. How do you respond to Patrick, and what's your role in helping?
I apologize to Patrick if he feels like we weren't sufficiently attentive to his question. The reality is we're in a balancing act here that if we responded to every single question that was coming in to us, I would have had to delegate a couple of full-time employees to do that. The truth is we've done a tremendous amount of outreach and worked closely with the Grocers Association for podcasts and panel presentations, public hearings around the state. And as we've gotten questions about uncertainties under the law or our regs, we've added to the frequently asked questions. So
although it sounds like Patrick says he couldn't even ask the question to get added. He did say, which also made me wonder, who asked these frequently asked questions if no one is allowed to ask
a
question?
Well, we got a lot of email submissions and letters that came into us. So we got a sense of what where the real uncertainties were. Now, you know, we've got questions like, hey, I have spring water. Does that have to be labeled? I mean, obviously not. But we got all kinds of questions, and I think we have done a good job of avoiding too much uncertainty as of July 1. Did we do a perfect job? No, and I apologize to Patrick if he felt slighted.
What are the rules for retailers?
And that's a great question. Basically, for retailers, they're not responsible for the labeling. It's the manufacturer who's responsible. Where the retailer comes into play is for bulk foods that are not individually packaged. So we're coming into corn season, for example. And so you walk into a grocery store and there's a big bin with, you know, 250 ears of corn there. Well, if those ears of corn are produced with the seeds produced with genetically engineered seeds, then the retailer, since the manufacturer isn't packaging it and whatever, they're just shipping it here, has to put up a sign that is sufficiently prominent that tells consumers that if you're going to get this corn or this kind of flour or whatever, that it's produced with genetic engineering. That's essentially the responsibility of the retailer. If they're preparing foods on site that are not for immediate consumption, then they could have an obligation to label. But the typical deli where, you know, I want a ham and Swiss or whatever with mayo and whatever,
right.
They are – because that's for immediate consumption.
Which is exempt from the rule.
That's exempt from the rule.
And the labeling of that the example that you gave, the bucket of corn, that's based on the – person selling the corn, the manufacturer or the grower, telling the retailer this is a GMO product?
The retailer is required to do some due diligence and make inquiry. But again, the responsibility, primary responsibility, would be from the manufacturer who's shipping the corn to the retailer. And in many of the large grocery store chains, they have their own farm system, and so it would sort of an all inside. They are the manufacturer and the retailer. But for the mom and pop grocery store, there's a responsibility to make due inquiry. But, you know, what we've said with this 6 months of being able to move foods off the shelves that were appropriately labeled when they were labeled, we've given quite a grace period there. We've also said that when we get complaints, we will communicate with the manufacturer and give the manufacturer, unless we can see intentional violations, 30 days to sort of cure a problem. We've also said that we really want voluntary compliance, that we don't want to be bringing enforcement actions left and right. And again, the sky didn't fall Friday, and it's not going to fall this Friday as it relates to GMO labeling. And I think in a matter of months, we'll see very, very substantial compliance with the law.
Compliance, not complaints, you said, right?
Compliance,
good, okay.
Yes.
Just making sure I heard you right. Shifting gears a little bit, we got a note from Dennis who says, is your office conducting any investigation into the demise of Burlington College?
We have been looking into some allegations about Burlington College. I'll just leave it at that.
Why are you picking your words so carefully on that?
An attorney general can be wise to pick words carefully. You know, if you had asked me 2 months ago, are you looking anything at JPEEK and EB-5 issues, I would have chosen my words very carefully. But for those affiliated with Burlington College, there are a lot of complaints about the way it closed and students getting access to their transcripts and everything. There are, you know, some questions about financing issues and everything that would be primarily federal in nature. So although I've chosen my words carefully because there has been a matter referred to our office, no imminent action is contemplated, and I don't know at the end of the day if there will be any action at all.
We're talking again with Bill Sorrell, Vermont's Attorney General. Sorry for making him come in on a day that he has a cold, but we appreciate him being here. And he's here to answer more of your questions. We're going to talk about the Volkswagen settlement with car owners and the possibility of Vermont suing the car company over deceptive practices or joining a lawsuit already settled by other states. We're also going to talk about gender-based pricing, how states can regulate toxic substances, and some of the sticky legal issues Sorrell and his office have found themselves embroiled in. If you have a question for the AG, call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're spending some time today with Vermont's Attorney General, Bill Sorrell. He's answering questions about some of the legal issues his office is keeping an eye on, like the GMO labeling law and VW lawsuits. He's also responding to your questions. You can post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk a little bit about this issue with Volkswagens. This has been was big news around the country. Your office recently announced the settlement of a federal lawsuit against Volkswagen, and basically affected owners in Vermont, about 3,000 owners, will be able to receive a payment of a little over $5,000.
It could be 5 to about 10, depending on the age of the vehicle.
So a minimum of 5.
Yeah, 5,100, yeah. I think.
And in addition to that, they can either have the company buy back their vehicle.
With the book value as of September 15th when the story all broke, September 15th of 2015. And then they have another option, which is if the EPA approves a so-called fix to take care of the excessive pollution from these diesel vehicles, that they can try that to have that done. But if their gas mileage, for example, goes unacceptably high for them or whatever, they would then be able to take advantage of the buyback. And now those are the issues that relate to private consumers who bought these vehicles. There are a couple of other components to the proposed settlement of the case, and it's going to be available for public comment for I think it's 30 days before the federal court needs to decide whether to accept it as proposed or to alter it. And there are a couple of things that are of concern to us. One is that in Vermont, we're concerned about two different things as it relates to Volkswagen. First of all, a violation or alleged violation of our Consumer Protection Act for unfair and deceptive acts and practices in commerce. And with Volkswagen, even in Vermont from our study thus far, making hundreds of thousands of representations into Vermont that these are clean, burning, whatever. They are well under emissions standards. You know, if you're green, you care about the environment, buy this vehicle, when in fact that it was only clean burning when it was being tested because of this cheat that they did technically. But huge in pollution issues. So they arguably misled consumers, which is allegedly a violation of our Consumer Protection Act. But Vermont is one of the states that has adopted a higher standard of more protective standard for cleaner air. So we're a victim in terms of on the pollution side of it. And one of the provisions of this settlement is a large remediation fund to try to reduce nitrogen oxide, which is an air pollutant, in the air nationally for those states that accept it. And Vermont's share allocation of that big pot of money is just under $18 million. But there are some technical folks at our Agency of Natural Resources who, as they look at the qualifying uses of that fund, are concerned that we don't have enough mass communication use of diesel, for example, that there's concerns that we might not be able to use our allocation. And so we've sort of arranged with the Department of Justice, with technical folks at the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, with our technical folks to get together to get to a greater level of confidence that we're going to be able to use all of our allocation. That's still a work in progress.
So the question for the state of Vermont is, does the state want to sign on to accept that part of this federal agreement?
The consumer piece, that's up to individual consumers and the class actions that are going on around the country and a couple of them here in Vermont.
So that it does affect those class action suits that were filed by private law firms.
Yes.
They will be party to this settlement.
Yes. But then there are two separate issues for the state. One, do we accept the remediation fund, our $17.8 million eligibility
under environmental violations.
Yes. And so we're trying to decide our level of comfort and whether we ask that the settlement be a little broader in terms of legitimate or permissible uses of the remediation fund. And then another piece that's smaller is a 2.5 $9 million payment to the state in lieu of our suing under our consumer protection for deceptive practices. And so we need to take a look at that. We need to take a look at the remediation fund. But we still retain the right to sue for penalties for a violation of our environmental protection.
Which you've suggested that you are interested in doing.
Yes, very much so. And if we're going to be suing on the environmental protection side, then we have to take a look at this $2.9 million and say, hey, you know, as you mentioned, Vermont has about 3,000 of these cars that were sold or registered in Vermont. That comes down to about $1,000 per car. And a question that I personally have, for example, is how much did Volkswagen make on one of these vehicles? And I'm making this number up, but if Volkswagen's net profit on one of these cars was $5,000 and they pay us a penalty of $1,000, that's just the cost of doing business. And what does that say to other car manufacturers or other manufacturers of other consumer products going forward that just pay a little money and you can get out from under? So,
plus, you've got to make a payout to all of the owners.
Well, yeah, but no one did this to Volkswagen other than Volkswagen. So I am not going to sit here and say, oh, poor Volkswagen. The reality is this huge multinational corporation essentially lied and cheated and polluted our state and our country, and I don't feel sorry for them one iota.
We got a note from Dale in Marshfield, who shared with us an email that he sent to several law firms about the effect that the VW scandal has had on his life and his small business, because he says he started Vermont TDI Imports. He sold slightly used TDIs, VW and Audi. And he says, as you can imagine, as of September 2015, I've essentially lost my business. Aside from the investment and a loss of good income, the worst part of this for me is that I've invested 10 years of my life, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and given my name and good reputation to a fraud. It was somewhat frightening enterprise for me in my 50s to go out and do this, a huge leap of faith. I don't know what I expect except the need to express that there are entities like myself that have been profoundly damaged by this fraud, persons and businesses that do not show up in most of the press that I've read. This loss will affect the rest of my personal life and my financial circumstances.
Well, dealers are certainly – I mean, I haven't seen information or evidence to the effect that dealers were aware that the cars they were selling on their lots were in fact not what they were – what Volkswagen was telling them they were. And so dealers are victims here too. And I'm not aware right now of a class action or lawsuits on behalf of dealers, but we might well see that. So I'm not sure if this gentleman, how widely he is swept to see, determine whether there are other similarly situated dealers who might unite in a claim against Volkswagen, but I would encourage him not to give up.
We got a few comments asking about your office's investigation of Annette Smith for practicing law without a license. Now, your office did investigate, declined to advance charges, so those were all dropped. But one of the people who actually wrote in about this was Annette Smith herself, who says, I would like Attorney General Sorrell to talk about his office's investigation of me for allegedly practicing law without a license. Why did his office move the case forward when all the evidence that I did not do what was alleged was contained in the complaint that was filed? I'd like him to explain how his office functions and how it happened that such a serious yet specious allegation was allowed to move forward.
I'm pleased that that question is being posed. We received a complaint from a Vermont lawyer of an alleged violation of the law by practicing law without a license.
And Annette Smith often works with people who are involved in dealing with environmental issues on their land or in their communities where a wind project, for example, is being proposed.
Wind is a big one, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so she was accused of operating without a law license, essentially advising in a legal manner these residents.
By an attorney who I think was involved in litigation relating to wind power. And so What we do as a matter of course, I'm really happy she asked this question, is that when we get a complaint like this or we get a complaint in the campaign finance arena, unless we think it's just totally bogus and in the campaign finance arena just being done primarily for partisan political reasons and, you know, when you see a complaint that goes to the media before it even comes to us, you get kind of a little suspicious about the games being played, is we send a letter to the person who's the subject of the allegation, said, we've received this. How do you respond? We do not go and issue publicly, oh, we got this complaint about John Doe and we're looking into it and all this stuff. You talked to me about my choice of words earlier. We don't do that. We communicated with Ms. Smith. She's the one that went public with the fact. I didn't even know the case was in our office when it broke publicly, that we were just doing this in our normal course. We didn't take any position that, in fact, she was in violation. We sent it off and said, we've gotten this complaint. How do you respond? Now, clearly, when you're in the issue of unlawful practice of law, there are potential First Amendment issues there. And we want our courts to be open. And we hope that the judiciary, which is really responsible for the management of the court systems, of the court system, will give more definition not only to my office but to other law enforcers for what is impermissible practice of law without a license. So this became a big deal and all the AG's office is being heavy-handed and everything. I plead not guilty. We got a complaint. We asked, how do you respond to this? And all of a sudden, the AG's office is in bed with big wind and trying to take down an individual who's opposed to wind power.
And you, so you deny, you categorically deny that.
I categorically deny that. I'm not a big fan of big wind.
Meaning what?
I when I ride my bicycle in some parts of Vermont and I look up on ridgelines and see wind power there, there are any number of times when I regret that view.
Are you more free to say stuff like that since you're not running again this year?
Maybe, but wait till I'm no longer AG.
What are we going to hear from you then?
We'll see. We'll see.
We're talking with Attorney General Bill Sorrell, and if you have a question for him, we have a couple more minutes. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your notes, your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You and the head of the Vermont Human Rights Commission decided to highlight illegal gender-based pricing last week and discriminatory practices. You gave some examples of retailers who would be selling, say, a women's nightgown and a men's nightshirt, and they would be the same, or pajamas maybe more appropriate, the same product but sold for significantly different prices. And you say this is illegal because it's gender-based pricing. Why isn't it just what the free market will bear? And if women are willing to pay $95 for a set of pajamas that men will only pay $65 for, so be it.
Well, let me switch your question a little bit. What if Jake's pharmacy sold men's shaving gear at one price for African-American men and another price for Caucasian men? I mean, and the African-American men were content to pay the extra amount. Would that be right? No. The reality is gender is one of our protected classes from discrimination, not only in employment but housing and in public accommodation, stores, restaurants, and all of the like, along with race, age, sexual orientation, handicapping condition. I could go on and on. The reality is to go into a dry cleaner and you're bringing in, you're there with I've got one of my suits. I have a wool suit. I need to have it dry cleaned. And there's a woman standing behind me who has a suit that she needs to be dry cleaned, a wool suit. Could be that she's got more wool in her suit than I, but probably not. And the reality is that in certain places in Vermont, because that's women's clothing, she's going to pay more than it costs me. Well, that's just not right. For three disposable razor blades in Vermont drugstores, the men's package is $3 for $4.99. The women's package, which are, you know, and the packaging is red as opposed to black or navy blue, is $6.99. A little kid's scooter, boy's scooter for a four-year-old or a five-year-old, $29.99. Essentially an identical scooter, but one that's pink and has some sparkles on it, is $49.99. And, you know, the average person in this state, in this country, knows that there's supposed to be equal pay for women. For doing similar work, they should get paid the same as the man working next to them. But a lot of people don't know that the same applies for the purchase of goods and the pricing of goods and services. And with women in this country only making on average about 75% or so of a comparably situated male, Vermont, we're a little better than that. It's about 84% in Vermont. But women are being paid less. And with this gender-based pricing, which is illegal, they're paying more for similar goods and services. So it's a double whammy where women are getting hurt, both sides. And so we put out this guidance. We, again, want more compliance. We hope we don't have to file a bunch of enforcement actions. But we want women to know that this is happening and it's against the law and speak up. And if they don't get relief, and in any event, they should call the Human Rights Commission and complain so that we know what's going on out there with individual retailers or providers of goods and services.
Bill Sorrell is Vermont's Attorney General for the next couple months anyway. He is not running for re-election. I think this is the first time in 10 election cycles that he won't be running for re-election.
That's right. I had a very good July 4th weekend.
No parades for this politician, but it sounds like we're going to have him on once January comes, because maybe some bombshells dropping then. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're very welcome, Jane. Thank you.
Coming up, how to stay safe if you head out on the lakes and streams in a boat this summer. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It was a successful holiday weekend on Lake Champlain, at least as far as the state police are concerned. Some boats ran aground, which might be causing some expensive headaches for their owners. But what the state police are concerned about are collisions and injuries, and the weekend was thankfully free of those, it sounds like. But earlier this summer, a man died in a boat collision on the lake. So joining us now to talk about boating safety is Corporal Kevin Mays, field coordinator for the State Police Marine Division. Corporal Mays, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for having us.
So this, it sounds like the holiday weekend, big on the lake for boats, both for just recreational activities, but of course to see fireworks as well. And it was by and large a safe one?
It was by and large a safe one. We didn't have any reported collisions or injuries. We had some people run their boats aground, but no reports of injuries, and that's what we look for.
And no reported injuries in other Vermont water bodies over the weekend either?
Not that I'm aware of.
So what's your actual role in regulating boating activity on the lake and on waterways?
So the state of Vermont, we operate under a grant from the U.S. Coast Guard to enforce boating safety, and that's strictly what my concern is, boating safety. We're not checking fishing licenses when we're out there. We just want to make sure everybody's operating legally and safely underway. And we, the state of Vermont, the state police, we have 30 auxiliaries that throughout the state that enforce boating regulations as it regard to safety.
So you mentioned that there were several boats that ran aground. That's not actually something you get involved with other than to check and make sure that there's no violation or injury, but you just basically say good luck with that?
No, we have regular patrols we put on the water. So when Lake Champlain is the best example, because that's where we have a lot of boating traffic at, probably the most in the state, obviously. So we have regular patrols out on Lake Champlain, and we have boats spread up and down the lake, as well as some sub-grant recipients like Colchester PD and Grand Isle Sheriff's Department. So when we sign on in Lake Champlain, we sign on with the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard's the point of contact for all 911 calls and such on Lake Champlain. So they'll look and see who's the closest boat. So they'll tell us about it. If somebody runs aground, we're going to go there, make sure that they're not in danger, they're not taking on water, they're not sinking. We don't want to take business from the marinas who maybe, you know, if you're out of gas or your battery's gone dead because you were listening to the radio just floating out there. You know, we're going to, then the Coast Guard's also going to put a call for a local mariner for that sort of thing, if somebody can respond and with a set of jumper cables and get the boat underway or bring them a gallon of gas. But we are going to respond when anybody's life is in jeopardy or they might be in danger. It's dark and you've got small kids. We're going to be heading there.
There was a fatal collision on Lake Champlain last month. Where does that investigation stand?
That's being investigated by Colchester Police Department. They have two people that work for their department that are trained marine collision investigators.
How often do really serious accidents and collisions like that happen on Lake Champlain?
We have been very fortunate on Lake Champlain for the amount of traffic that we have, that we're normally boating fatalities in this state are historically fairly low since we started our education program.
Well, let's get into that a little bit. Let's talk about some of the general safety tips that you want to make sure that people who are out on any kind of boat on the lake or any lake in Vermont are aware of. Any sort of general ones that we should talk about?
Well, if you're operating a motorboat in the state of Vermont, and that could be your sailboat with your motor attached to the back end, so it's any vessel that's powered by a motor, that's including an electric trolling motor as well. If you're born after January 1st, 1974, you're required to take a boating safety course in the state of Vermont.
Another one is you're actually required to wear life jackets?
If you're under the age of 12 and you're an open deck vessel, you are required to have a life jacket on when you're underway.
What about if I'm on a, if I'm an adult on a stand-up paddleboard, I don't have to wear one?
You don't have to wear one, but you have to have one with you. So that is a vessel by Coast Guard definition. It's a boat, unless you're using it in a surf zone. And we really don't have any surf zones in the state of Vermont. So if you're on your paddleboard, you need to have a life jacket with you. You know, the recommendation would be that they make these great inflatable life jackets that you can wear as a belt, and it's there with you. But we see a lot of people strapping their life jackets down on their paddleboard. So they're going to save their paddleboard if they get separated from their paddleboard, but they're not, the life jacket's not really handy. So sometimes it's worth just buying the life jacket that you're comfortable wearing on a paddleboard.
Do you actually wear a life jacket when you're out on the water?
We are required. I'm on my state police patrol vessel, I am required by the grant that I have to have a life jacket on it all the time.
And if you're out just recreating by yourself?
I have several stand-up paddleboards and kayaks, and I will admit that sometimes I have my life jacket on the paddleboard as opposed to on me, but like I said, but you know, this weekend yesterday I had a day off, so I was recreating on my paddleboard, and I had my life jacket with me the whole time.
What are the rules about alcohol consumption and boats?
We don't have an open container law. We don't have, so you're allowed to consume alcohol while you're in the boat. We prefer you wait till you get off the water. The heat and the movement of the boat and the light reflecting. It introduces a lot of fatigue factors when you're out boating. We would prefer people wait till they get done on the water, you know, and enjoy the beverage, adult beverage, after they get off the water. Those factors that I just mentioned just make any alcohol you consume worse. You're going to get dehydrated out there, and the alcohol is going to dehydrate you further, and it's going to make the alcohol affect you a little bit more than if you're on dry land.
So there is that advice that you're giving, you know, just wait to consume alcohol. Technically, you are legally able to consume alcohol, but if you are operating the boat, if you're driving the boat, you have to comply by the same drunk driving limit that people operating cars do?
You do. It's that 0.08. If it affects you more, you could be operating under the influence of alcohol, not necessarily clearly intoxicated, but you could be under the influence at a lower level because you're dehydrated, because of the other factors that's going to affect your abilities out there.
So you are not allowed to drive a boat impaired, basically, is the law.
That is the law. We look for that every boat stop we make to to make sure everybody's operating safely out there.
Does that apply to non-motorized boats like canoes and kayaks as well?
Technically, it does.
So technically, you cannot be operating a canoe if you are impaired by alcohol.
Impaired, yes. So a DWI on the water or a BWI on the water, boating while intoxicated, will cost your ability to operate a vessel for a year.
Corporal Kevin Mays is field coordinator of the Vermont State Police Marine Division. We've been talking a little bit about boating safety. This is the season for people to be out on the water. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today, Corporal.
Well, I appreciate you having us. This is our job, is to spread the message. We just want everybody to have a safe summer and enjoy the waters of the state.
All right, so that will do it for Vermont Edition for today. Tomorrow, we turn our attention back to the political scene. For the next 3 days, actually, we'll be hearing from the three Democratic candidates for lieutenant governor. We start with House Speaker Shap Smith of Morristown. We'll discuss his thoughts on health care, the minimum wage, taxes, and other top issues. You can email your questions or comments for Shap Smith or the other candidates to vermontedition@vpr.net. And be sure to listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.